Mr. Cheeseman, reel 27. You wanted to give me some information that you'd forgotten on previous reels, Mr. Cheeseman.
Yes, that's right. Yes, on my last tape, I couldn't remember certain facts. In the meantime, of course, I've dug it out of my memory or looked at some memory jerkers. And the camp that we were in Surrey, the one that we left when we immediately went abroad to the Middle East, the name of it was Thursley. It was a temporary camp, but I believe me, looking at the modern maps and things like that, I think it's more permanent now. Nevertheless, Thursley. And I also talked about my pay, and I kept saying 4 and 4 pence as a driver operator for a qualified soldier. And it stuck in me, Gullet, because I knew it was wrong. I got 2 of a day to start with, and when I got wireless operator, it was 1 and 4, which puts it up to 3 and 4 pence, not 4 and 4 pence. And then, of course, when I became tank maintenance fitter, got another 1 and 4 on top of that, which of course put it to 4 and 8 pence, which was a very, very, very good wage in those days, I think it should. In fact, I think it was about 7 and 6 pence less than what my father was getting for the 4 days without going on the pit, because he had to live on that. This was pocket money for me, as it were. Now then, you asked me about the types of tanks that we had. And of course, all I could give you was what we nicknamed them. Well, we had the Cruiser Tank Mark IV, which was the Christie Cruiser, as we called it. And we also had the A9 Mark I Cruiser Tank, which we called the Valentine Tank, which is quite wrong, and the Valentine Tank was the infantry tank. The reason why we called it, the two got mixed up, is it was the 6 bogies looking along one side. It started with a large bogie and 2 small bogies, and then a space and 2 small bogies and a large bogie, you know, as the Valentine was, and of course we just automatically called it. And then we had the Crusader Cruiser Tank Marks 1 to 3, which was the sort of modern with the, not the sloping sides to the turret, and not the cast round legs of Valentine, but a sort of the sides of a diamond, as it were. Well, that's the tanks we had, as well as, of course, I'm not sure whether I mentioned or not, but we haven't, no. There's been an awful lot of American stuff coming in later.
And were these the tanks that you went to the Middle East with?
This is the tanks that we went to the Middle East, yes. An assortment of, a ragtag and mocktail, which had worked half worn out through exercises in Britain before we went there. So, and as I say, I think it's 2,000 miles a set of tracks could do on those tanks. And we'd already done over 1,000 miles before we put them on a ship to go abroad. But that's we'd come to that. So shall we start with where we left off?
What were these tanks like from the point of view of fighting vehicles in relation to the German tanks you're about to meet?
Well, you know, what you have to realise, I'm telling you now what we thought there at that particular time, and we were brainwashed. Please remember, Goebbels had nothing on the British as regards propaganda. And of course, our tanks were absolutely not. The Germans had any cardboard tanks then. That's what we were told. Were we in for a million? Our tanks were, from an engineering point of view, was a magnificent piece of engineering. Rather, if I can put it like this, the Rolls Merlin engine for the Spitfire, the finest bit of engineering in the world. Now, due to bottlenecks in production later on in the war, they put a Rolls Merlin engine into a tank. The biggest load of rubbish that you ever came across, you see, because it wasn't designed for, and that was our tanks. Beautifully designed, high technology, and that was their downfall. Should have been built like a mangle. I'll be talking about this later on when we get the American tanks. as regards the two-pounder gun that we went to, it was high velocity, and I do believe, forgetting the 88 by the way, I do believe we had a superiority in tank guns over the Germans, but we couldn't get anywhere near enough to use them, and this of course was due not so much to the technical side of the tank battalion, those days, and I say tank battalion rather than the RAC with the cavalry, because of the tactics. It's all Rommel. He just used to show his tanks out in front and say, hey, come on, cut us through, guys, and then retreat back and bring us on, and then he retreated back through his screen around his tank guns. Boom, 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 finish. So the two-pounder gun was at the beginning of the war a fairly good gun. Its only drawback was that it could only fire on Pearson instead of having a handy little high explosive shell behind it. It quickly, of course, we quickly got outgunned on that screen.
Reliability in the desert?
The engines, the motor power in the trainer was reasonable for that time. I hesitate when I say reasonable because it was tracks that used to give us problems. But why I hesitate is that can you imagine today a motor car engine failing because one cylinder blew up? Or can you imagine a motor car engine today coming to a clanking halt because a conrod had been thrown through the sump? That's the sort of things we had. Which wasn't altogether outlandish for the technical advancement of the day. And I think I've already said that we maintenance fitters, really 90% of our job was doing what under normal circumstances the driver would do, sort of day-to-day maintenance in there, with of course the odd highly technical stuff as it were. But of course the driver could never ever change his tracks and what have you. He would adjust them, but we would do that. The driver, as you'll appreciate the fact, a member of an active tank crew, he had sufficient on his plate without bothering about the details of maintenance on it. That's where we came in. I suppose whilst I'm on the subject of what we used to do, as I say, 90% could have been done by the driver. You know. Our next almost equally important job, battalion maintenance, was the battalion handyman. And later on we're telling you about making a refrigerator in the desert. But
how did you have any work on your vehicles because of now being in desert sand conditions?
Oh yes. Again, this is what the driver would do, but and that was the cleaning of air filters. The air filters those days were you didn't change the elements like the air. They sort of through how can I put it? If you you know what centrifugal force is, anything that's on a disc that's spinning hard, it will fling off the side. That was the principle of the air filters those days. It was made to go through and create centrifugal force where the dust would be flung off, which would go to the bottom and into a pool of oil, otherwise it would come back up again. And the digging out of that solid, 4 inches deep by, we say, nearly 18 inches long by a foot wide, that the floor of that air filter, one on either side of the tank, would be absolutely solid. We had to use we used cold chisels, but not with a hammer, of course, to dig it out. The sand, of course. Heat, we didn't have too bad a problem with heat. other than our own ability to stand it, because you remember we weren't acclimatized. We came out and straight into the desert. For example, it was December when we first went into the desert. We went into the desert with KD. All other winters after that, we went back into our surgery. We were too cold. I can show you photographs in fact in the desert, not only with surgery, but whacking great army overcoats on. So cold. First thing in the morning, of course, before the sun got up and said, "Right, I'll make you take that one off." Oh, the other thing, of course, tell someone about this business. You'll appreciate the fact that the icy cold nights in England would be balmy, of course, but by comparison, I'm using the term icy. The icy cold nights and the unbearably hot during the day, especially in the summertime, the temperature range was colossal. So, we vehicle blokes on vehicles. You would go out, start away in the morning with proper, correct tyre pressure gauges. Tyre pressures, you know, as laid down, I don't know, 35 psi, something like that. In the course of the morning, as the heat rides up, Nile gets up, and by about 1 o'clock in the morning, hold it, about 1300 hours, that's what I was trying to get out, it would be just about the maximum, and your tyres would burst. So you got out and let the pressure out with your tyre pressure gauge down to the proper pressure gauge. Great for the rest of the afternoon. Then at the night time, still a lot of heat of the day is there, but of course it gets very, very cold very quickly, and the sun goes down very like a wallop, as it were. And by morning, you get up and you've got soft tyres all around. You've got to blow them off. Now, that of course was okay because all vehicles except one that I came across had an engine driven tyre pressure pump, so it was just a question of going down in the morning. So I even had that chore, that sort of thing, you know, the different things. Yeah. But we never had any frozen engines in the desert.
We may as well talk about living in the desert whilst we've touched on the subject. Water, what was the situation there? I'm thinking of terms of water.
Could I sort of say, would you lean back for the time being, and I'll pick up where I left off before, and because I think it's important that instead of telling you now how wily we got and how clever we got, I think I ought to tell you how absolutely, you know, we were absolutely tired of it, you know. And that was when we left Amarilla. I think we were there about a fortnight. But anyway, we left Amarilla before Christmas. And our vehicles, we went to the docks.
Mm-hmm. We've got the dock situation.
We picked up, because we picked up our vehicles there. And that was the last I saw of tanks for quite a while. They went onto the train, and the railhead, of course, was at Merthyr Mae Trwyth, so at least they got that far. Later on, of course, the railhead got as far as Tobruk, but anyway, at that time, Merthyr Mae Trwyth. So off we went, and on the coast road, of course. And we were in the middle of the desert as regards the coast road, but absolutely tired of it. And when we got to Merthyr Mae Trwyth, of course, we took to the desert, 3 or 4 miles inland from the coast. And it was then we had to check up and readjust tracks and all that sort of thing. But I remember we stopped off at Sidi Barani. Now, we were never told about anything, you know, i.e. be careful and what have you. We were never told that at all, but we stopped off at Sidi Barani and had a look at the Italians' fortifications, dugouts and what have you. I mean, today we would have been given a lecture on if you see any ammunition or whatever, do not touch it. Well, you know, and It was in another a chap in another squadron, but he actually picked up one of the hand grenades of the line, and of course there were red tin things, and of course there was no pin to pull out, and he like that, what's this, and he slung it down, and of course when he slung it down, it went off, being a time, of course it only sort of punctured his skin around his leg, man. But you know, it could have been serious. We fitters were a little bit more careful than that. We were, you know, looking at the mechanical side if we could find it, and indeed we realised that there was a number of items which came in very handy later on. We didn't take them. I'll tell you about them later. But what we did collect was a lot of fleas in our clothing. Oh dear me! Now, what we did for that was, if you were not a smoker, because at night time you just could not sleep for fleas. At night time, if you were not a smoker, you would get a piece of cotton wool, you know, a piece of rag or something like that, soak it in petrol, and take it to bed with you. Now, by the time that had evaporated, you were asleep. And whilst that was on, there was no fleas biting. But of course, if you're a smoker, what you do is you just start living there. And talking of that, by the way, we very quickly learned to, when you're setting your beds down in the desert, your ground sheet goes down first. Along the edges of your ground sheet, put stones so the edges are kept up. So anything crawling along crawls under your bed, under your ground sheets, rather than over the end of your bed. Because at the same time, when we were digging, whenever we stopped, of course, it was then we were talking right to ourselves, and we stopped slip trenches, which was easy in there, isn't it? But while digging one, I came across my first scorpion, and it was a big black one. I suppose that was very handy, because there's, you know, there is these things about. I'll tell you a rather amusing story about this on the El Alamein night, but I'll come to that later. So, we got to as far as Saloon. Now the tanks, we left the tanks then because they went up Hellfire Pass, because the road out, the coast road from Saloon up into Libya and Port Capuzzo, it was zigzag. And that was my first experience of driving, and I could watch those temperatures of the lorry going up and up and up and up and up, and then it starts boiling, stop. And by the way, one of our things which we did in England, we prepared all our vehicles for the desert in England at that Thursday camp. One of the things we did in England is fit every vehicle with a condensation tank, so that if it started boiling, you would condense the steam and you wouldn't lose your water, it would be collected in this tank. I don't think they were ever successful, but they were fitted there. Anyway, as I say, they were there, we had to stop on water because we were loaded down to the gunwales. When we got to the top, it was dark, and we did a bit more looting there than Fort Capuzzo. And that's where I was first introduced to the Italian equivalent of Perrier water. There was loads and loads and loads of bottles of it, which was very good, because all our drinking water since leaving the Delta was taken from local beers, you know, B-E-R-E. We used to say that, fancy getting water from a beer. and it was brackish, and quite frankly, in England, the water companies would be fine for, but and this was pure my introduction to Perrier water, it was the Italian equivalent. It was also the place where we first started saying, "Fools are sleeping on the floor, we've got a lorry here," albeit with work benches and things like that, but we started sleeping in the lorry and in the front of the lorry as well. Next day, we were to travel from Fort Kapuzu. By the way, the tanks are gone. We saw no more tanks. From Fort Kapuzu, we left for the next destination, which was El Adem. Not El Alamein. El Adem, which was an Italian aerodrome about 10 miles or so south of Tobruk. That's where we were going to stop. Unfortunately, that morning, it was sort of muggy weather and what have you, and soon the wind arose and we were in the middle of a sandstorm, the very first item in a sandstorm. And we were told when it was coming along, we were told, right, you are in convoy, get up so that you can just see the vehicle in front of you. And it got that bad that we realised that we would have to be within we couldn't see the vehicle in front of you. The length of the desert, the bonnet in front of you, prevented that. And so I stopped. I mean, far better ease off a little bit, because understanding the sandstorm, it's like a foggy, you know, a bit of a blustery fog here. It lifts and goes down again, lifts and goes down again. Anyway, I stopped. And it was a little while before the it lifted. And when it lifted, I was the only vehicle in the entire Western Desert. By the way, we always travel at the rear of all kinds. They disappeared off the face of the earth. And the speed that they were going, I mean, the horizon was probably, 5 miles away? Well, they could never have got any further than a mile away. They'd gone. So, right you are, we were told that when we got lost in the desert, just stay put until night time and when they'll come forward, you see. So we did that. And we thought, well, we'll have a drink and what have you. And this sounds awful, let's have a wash before this. We were absolutely, utterly unused to desert water. And I say we were using water as if
easy to get.
Yeah. And of course, next morning, of course, they did come and get us. Well, I've since realised why we were lost in the desert and why we didn't keep an eye out. And that is that there would be a valley or a wadi between us and the horizon, which of course you couldn't see. That's where the battalion was. If we kept watching every time the dust cleared, that we would have seen them. But no, of course we didn't do this. And I say we arrived at El Adem.
What are the signs of a dust storm coming? Sandstorm coming?
Don't really.
Does the climate?
I don't think there's any specific, though, because later on we experienced this, and I think it's lots of people wrote about it because it was most unusual. And there's later on that is that here is a lovely, beautiful, there were no beautiful days in the flaming sun. You know, we used to dream of this glorious, foggy, wet, cold November day. Well, anyway, glorious summer's day there, isn't it? And there on the horizon was a line, dark line, which gradually grew and grew and grew, and we found that it was a cliff, a solid cliff, coming towards us. And by the way, the little bit of wind that was coming was blowing towards this. And it was so thick, this sand. And it was travelling at probably about 5 miles an hour. Because, you know, when it hit us, poof, you know, and we run out of it, you know, and of course, you know, run 10 or 20 yards, we run out of it. And by the way, we just about lost ourselves as regards getting back to our vehicles and that. Now, they're so thick.
And what effect has it upon a man in a sandstorm?
Bloody annoying, you know, sorry. You know, can I tell you a joke of this story? The sandstorm had blown itself right out, and it had been a severe one. And we started ridding ourselves the damn stuff out of all clothing, out of all ears and eyes and mouth. And whilst we were doing that, Bert, who was the joker in the pack, was heard to say, "When this bloody war is over, and I get to take the missus and the kids on holiday to the seaside, I'll murder the first one that suggests covering daddy with a scant." That was a joke for a long time, huh? But no, it was annoying. The sodding bloody Middle East, rotten old bloody Egypt, you know, it made you annoyed more than anything. Incidentally, we did on occasions use our gas mask to in a really bad way. And other times, of course, there were just dust storms. You get these twisters in the desert. Not like in America, but you get one about, say, 2 foot in diameter twisting away. And out of curiosity, I deliberately stepped into one day. But, come on, never step into another. That was up the nose, and, you know. So what these things in America like, just freaking cars over them, as I say.
You'd be meeting flies now, were you, for the first time?
Yes, yes.
How bad were they? What?
Well, again, you say we were not used to the really bad conditions of flies, but as compared with the English fly, they were dreadful. I can't understand, they were very intelligent, those Egyptian flies. You would probably be sitting down having a meal, or probably reading a paper, months old, of course, but reading a paper, and they would be flying on you couldn't really. So you put the paper down and pick up your fly spot, and there wasn't a single fly within 10 miles of you. And they would remain so until you put the fly spot down again, and there were millions of them. I'll tell you later on as well how an army policy was trying to reduce this fly business. But that became, by the way, the wildlife quite astonishingly abundant in the desert, by the way. The wildlife became one of our pastimes because, as someone once said, war is 5% terrible action and 95% boredom. It was rather like that in the desert at times, too. Although I withdraw that because that was the case where we were confronting General Montgomery, but we were confronting General Western Desert all the time. Like Napoleon.
What kind of activities did you get up to with the wildlife?
We would have a bet on what these ants, huge ants. If you were sitting down having bullion biscuits, the crumbs of biscuit, they'll come down and pick up a piece of it. And so we deliberately break a piece of biscuit, a little bit bigger than that, and we would bet on if we put a piece down, which we knew was bigger than that being carried away, we would bet on could an ant move that or couldn't it, that sort of thing, you know. Of course, the old game with the old scorpion with the ring of fire, and don't take this for, you'll say, oh yes, when he sees he can't get out of the ring of fire, he stings the back of his head and kills himself. Fool, he stuns himself, but he doesn't kill himself. I know we had a huge one day. Must have been, 4, possibly 5 inches from tip to tip to tail, you know. And we played around with him for quite a while, and then of course finished up with a ring of fire thing like that. And then he stung himself to death, as we thought, oh, that was the end. We forgot him, went and had a cup of tea or something like that, and came back, and I touched him. He was there dead, and we thought, I touched him with the boot, the Tommy boot, thick, solid ammunition boot, and I really felt it as his tail came over.
Are they obviously, they were dangerous then if they stung you.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I was put in hospital there. Again, this is not knowing that it would take your boots off before you go to bed, and that instead of turning the damn things upside down, and I'll put my finger in, and it was just a tiny little Scorpion, and lumped under my arm, and really, the doctor, well, I didn't have to, but the doctor sent me the CCS for a few days, and we were not at natural at the time, and it was, I learned a lesson there, right?